Simon has roots all the way back, not only into virtualization. I think he's responsible for some of what we see in clustering
That's right.
today. So he is a huge clustering nerd. Simon has a problem. If you're in the market for a Maserati, when I was up there for MBA, we rode around in this Maserati, and now he's discovered they won't take it on trade. And it's such a problem. I really feel for you. First world problems for sure. So Simon's going to talk to us about Hyper-V high availability best practices with failover clustering. So it's a place he has a lot of expertise. So Simon, over to you, bud.
All right, thank you. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming to System Center Universe. And for those of you watching online, thanks for attending as well. So this is my, I think, third or fourth System Center Universe now. I go to the international ones as well. And I really do enjoy it as a community thing. So my big piece of feedback to all of you out there, try to be interactive. Meet with all the sponsors, meet with all the speakers. And for those of you that are online, please tweet to us as well. We are very active on the Twitter world. So I'll be more than happy to address your questions too. And thanks to Pete and team for putting this on. So what we're going to be covering today is really taking a look at virtualization throughout the stack here and how we provide high availability for it. We want to think about using these virtual machines, using a failover cluster to give you the high availability. But you've got to think about availability throughout the rest of the data center too, starting with your hardware, making sure that that's resilient, that that's fault tolerant, using best practices like RAID, redundant storage, redundant networks. You want to think about high availability for the virtual machines themselves, and that's what's going to be the focal point today, how we actually provide workload high availability. We could then also provide high availability within the virtual machines as well. If you take two virtual machines, create a cluster from them, that's known as a guest cluster. So you can have physical clustering and virtual clustering as well, and we're going to be talking about the best practices with both of those. We also want to think about having high availability for our storage so that those virtual machines can always access their virtual hard disks. Management high availability, keeping your systems online, like System Center Virtual Machine Manager. How do you make sure that that doesn't crash so that it can stay online and keep doing load balancing, redistribution, things like that? And last but not least, site high availability. What happens if you lose your entire data center? So as we go through these, we're really going to first kind of take a look at some of the best practices around planning your cluster deployments. We're going to talk about optimizing the physical host and then optimizing the properties for each of the virtual machines. Now, sorry, could I get the clock started as well, please, guys? Thanks. So due to some of the time constraints, we'll see how the demos go. I do want to keep this interactive, so please do ask me questions. And a little bit more context from the introduction Pete gave. I did spend 4 years on the actual engineering team for the clustering. So I built a lot of the actual technologies that we're going to be discussing today. So we could go pretty deep, pretty technical across these. So first, let's talk about planning. What are the best practices or the considerations when you get started? Well, very first thing, you want to make sure you pick the right host operating system. These are, of course, Windows Server that we're talking about here. And there's basically three different options that you can take a look at: Hyper-V Server, Windows Server Standard Edition, and the Data Center Edition. Now, there's also Windows Server Foundation, Windows Server Essentials. Those don't support clustering, so we don't want to consider those as an option. Kind of the key differentiators, though, is Hyper-V Server. It is a free operating system. We'll talk a little more about it on the next slide. But big advantages that is, if you're looking to do a clean deployment, you just want to have a basic host. Microsoft gives this away to you for free. So are there any VMware users in the room that are thinking of moving over to Hyper-V? Here's a great way to go make that move. You don't need to spend anything on licenses for the host platform. However, the big limitation here, there's no licenses for the virtual machines. So you still need to go and get a license for what is running in that guest operating system. If you're using Linux, you can actually have a free solution throughout the stack. And what I found, I worked on the VMware Compete team at Microsoft as well. What we found was a lot of VMware customers could move over to Hyper-V for almost free. Most VMware customers already had Microsoft licenses because they were using things like SQL Server or Exchange or SharePoint within the VMs already. And they were able to completely replace that underlying VMware fabric for zero cost. Obviously, there's cost for deployment, but no licensing costs. So that's kind of nice. The next one we have is Windows Server Standard Edition. If you're going highly virtualized, I don't recommend using this either. It includes the license for the host and the license for two virtual machines, but that's it. you only get two of those VMs licensed for free. What you really want to use is the Data Center Edition, because when you get one host license, you get licenses for all of the virtual machines for free as well. That's built in. So as powerful as that host is, you can run as many VMs as you want on there. So you really want to kind of look at option number one here, the completely free version, but no guest licenses, or option three, the paid version, but an unlimited number of guest licenses. So kind of some trade-offs there based on how big your infrastructure is. Now, I mentioned the Hyper-V service SKU. Again, this is that free one. I want to be clear, it's not an evaluation edition. So it's not going to go and expire after 90 days and you have to reinstall it. It is completely free. It includes all of the clustering features, all of the virtualization features, the same scale, everything that you would get with a traditional Hyper-V host. But again, no licenses for inside the VMs. Now, the other challenge that a lot of people have is it looks a lot like Windows Server Core. There is no graphical user interface. Now, in general, you do want to go ahead and install Windows Server Core whenever possible, or Hyper-V Server whenever possible. Because the big benefit of having no graphical user interface, this can actually give you higher availability. And here's why. If you think about what happens with the GUI, there's a lot of different components there. There's a lot more code that's actually in Windows Server to go and run that GUI. So by not having that additional code in there, not only do you have a smaller installation footprint, meaning the actual operating system on disk is smaller, but there's a smaller attack surface too. Less security vulnerabilities. This means you need to install less patches, which means you need fewer reboots, so you get higher availability. So best practice whenever you can, use Hyper-V Server, or if you're not going to use that, use the Core Edition without a GUI. That's going to give you the highest availability for your cluster. Now, the other challenge people say about the Hyper-V Server, you know, with no GUI is, hey, I'm not a scripting guy, right? I don't want to go in and use PowerShell the whole time to go and build my cluster. Well, you actually don't have to. It does have full remoting support. So you can manage this free version with a full instance of Hyper-V Manager, with Failover Cluster Manager, with System Center Virtual Machine Manager, or even other third-party tools like Five9 Manager. And Five9 Manager, that's one of the products my company built. That is actually a full GUI that runs directly on Windows Server Core and directly on Hyper-V Server. So even if you can't do remoting capabilities, you can actually get a full GUI that runs on these boxes as well. It's the only product available that does that. So what's kind of the big challenge, right? Why doesn't everybody just go and deploy this version for all of their infrastructure? Well, keep in mind, this only supports Hyper-V and clustering. This doesn't include Active Directory. It doesn't include file services, things like that. So you're still going to need probably have a full Microsoft environment running anyway. And these are really designed just to be those Hyper-V hosts. So Microsoft also pushed up their scale numbers with the last release as well. 64 node clusters, 8,000 VMs a cluster, over 1,000 VMs per node. Now, a lot of Microsoft scales numbers are actually to compete with VMware. You know, every release, each of the companies kind of tries to outdo each other. Recently, VMware released version 6 or 6.1. They actually have higher scale numbers than these. So my assumption here is going to be when Windows Server 2016 comes out, you're going to see all of these numbers jump again for probably double, maybe more. Now, the reason why Microsoft hasn't actually announced what those scale numbers are, they don't do performance testing until the product's almost ready. Now, don't get me wrong, they're constantly doing performance testing, but they don't actually go and say, here's the scale numbers which our products can support until the product's almost completed. So you're probably going to hear Microsoft's new numbers probably late summer, a couple of months before the new version of Windows Server comes out. Now, another best practice here as you're thinking about planning is how many levels of clustering and high availability do you want? Now, you guys probably are familiar with host clustering. That's where you have the two physical servers and you have a virtual machine that's going to move between them. Like we have in this image here, we have two separate clusters, two virtual machines. What we can actually do then is take those two virtual machines and create a cluster from them. This is, again, the virtual cluster or a guest cluster. Now, the advantage to this is the workload that's running inside the virtual machine, like the SQL Server, we get high availability for that workload, for that application. What this means is when you need to patch the guest operating system, or if the VM crashes, we can fail over that SQL workload to the other active virtual cluster node. So what's happening on the physical level is we're moving VMs between the physical servers, and then in the virtual level, we're moving the application between the virtual machines. So it's essentially a cluster running on top of a cluster. It still needs shared storage. It still needs to pass the cluster validation test. But this really kind of gives you the best of both worlds, and we recommend this to all of our customers. Now, it does add a level of complexity. You've got multiple clusters running. But you can really try to optimize this by setting up different policies. You know, you want to make sure that all of your virtual cluster nodes aren't sitting on a single physical server, because if you lose that physical server, you've lost your entire guest cluster. So we're going to talk about those best practices later to try to optimize this type of model. Now, next thing that Microsoft did a lot of improvement on is really trying to get specific validation tests for Hyper-V. So you guys, if you've done clustering, you've probably seen the cluster validation tool for a while. It's kind of that built-in best practice analyzer. It's required for support. You've got to make sure that all of the tests pass to have a supported cluster. And what Microsoft did in the 2012 R2 release was add a lot of tests specifically for Hyper-V. And you're going to see them continue doing that moving forward. Kind of the way the cluster team does their engineering design is they'll build the base platform that's going to support all of the different clustered workloads. So DHCP, DNS, iSCSI, file server, things like that. Then once they've got the base product, they do optimization for four specific roles: SQL, Exchange, Hyper-V, and file server. So what you're going to see with those four different roles, you're going to see extra hooks, extra knobs, different optimizations built into the core cluster and platform. And we found that about 95% of all cluster deployments worldwide are running those four workloads. So that's why the cluster team really kind of focused their engineering efforts on making this work really well for Hyper-V, SQL, Exchange, and file server. So with these new built-in tests, it's just going to really make sure that the virtualization platform's stable. You're going to make sure that everything's compatible, that you can do live migration, move your virtual machines back and forth without any challenges. Now, the next thing that you want to think about planning is if you have an existing cluster. So does anybody in this room still have a 2008 or 2008 R2 cluster? A couple of you, OK. 2012 R2? Most of you in the room, cool. Anybody tried 2016 yet? No, not yet, OK. So what we've done here, as far as upgrading the cluster, traditionally, you have to use this built-in tool, a migration wizard. It's called the Copy Cluster Roles Wizard. What that's basically going to do is point, you have to have your new cluster set up. You point it to your old cluster, and it basically copies the roles forward. Now, this works. You got to still, you know, reconfigure the storage on the back end. But the downside of using this tool is you have to go and build a new cluster to go do this migration process. So if I have a four-node cluster and I want to upgrade all of the nodes, I basically have to evict two nodes, create another two-node cluster. So I have two-node clusters. We do the migration, destroy the old cluster, and then add the two nodes back. So that process is kind of cumbersome. It's kind of time-consuming. And probably the biggest challenge customers have is the breaking change, the fact that you actually have to now go build a new cluster, which means you have to have a new cluster name. And that can create different types of applications. So what Microsoft started doing between 2012 R2, and moving forward is supporting live migration for virtual machines, where you can actually live migrate to the next version. Now, challenges about that. So between 2012 R2, we still had to have the two different clusters, but we'll do a live migration of the VM. What Microsoft has committed to do moving forward are seamless upgrades, seamless downtime. And in the past, this used to be called rolling upgrades. If anybody did clustering back between 2003 and 2008, we actually supported this. They then broke compatibility. Too many changes were happening in the code. And now it's resupported again. And so what these rolling upgrades do, instead of having to take two clusters and migrate between them, we can just use the same cluster. All we do is upgrade the first node, and it still lives within that same cluster. So one of my nodes is running 2016. I can do a live migration to test that the VM still works on it. And what's nice with 2016, I can also live migrate back. Between 2012 R2, it was a one-way path. You could only go forward. Now, between 2012 R2 and 2016, you can go both ways. So it actually really allows you to test that your VMs are still going to function well on the new platform. Now, after you've gone and live migrated to them and you've gradually upgraded all four nodes in the cluster, so all the nodes are running 2016, we still have the same cluster name, no changes there. There's a switch that you can flip and say the cluster functional level is now running at 2016, turn on all the new features. So kind of think of this as like Active Directory forests, right? You know, everything's running at like 2008, you upgrade the entire infrastructure, then you go and change the domain level and upgrade it to 2012, something like that. So kind of the same model that Active Directory is using here. Now, anytime you use Hyper-V on a cluster, there's a bunch of optimizations that have been hidden into it. And these are kind of some of the behind the scenes things, but these actually made the cluster function a lot better. Now, first of all, we actually did talk about the cluster validation, right? So you can do this, you get additional tests. Hyper-V clusters also support a type of virtual hard disk that can be shared across two virtual servers. So you know how we talked about that guest cluster, right? That's the virtualized cluster. That still needs shared storage. We could go and hook it into a single virtual hard disk and go and share that between the virtual cluster nodes. We'll talk a little more about the shared VHDX later. The third big enhancement, which is hidden, is how the cluster does its updating. So within a cluster, there's an engine that's running behind the scenes known as the Global Update Manager, or the GUM. And every time a cluster node makes a change to any type of application, it starts a virtual machine, somebody changes a property, we do a health check. Basically, any time that something changes within that environment, the active node that's changing that virtual machine, it goes and sends an update to every other cluster node, and it says, hey, we're making a change here. Make sure that you're aware of this change. Now, what happened in the past was every time we wanted to make a change, let's say I bring my virtual machine online, it goes and sends out that request to every other cluster node saying, we're changing this resource to being online. And then it has to wait for every single cluster node to respond back and say, OK, we accept this change. That's one of the biggest delays of virtual machine startup. It's this messaging that happens back and forth between these two different nodes. Because if you think about these virtualized hosts, they tend to be running at near full capacity. They often have their networks fully saturated because they're doing a live migration or something like that. So this mechanism actually caused a lot of problems in the past. It would stop virtual machines from starting, or you'd have like a 3-minute delay while it was starting up simply because of this messaging protocol. So what they did to fix it in this most recent release, 2012 R2, is rather than wait for all of the different nodes to respond back, they just need to have a majority of them respond back. So almost like quorum. So that way, if there's one particular host that's slow, its networks are busy, it's not going to go and delay the operations of the entire system. And then the fourth big kind of hidden change here are the heartbeat settings. Now, the heartbeat settings are what the cluster nodes use to ping each other to make sure that they're still running, that they're still alive. Now again, what we found with virtualization was a lot of the networks tended to be saturated. Again, live migration traffic, customer traffic, things like that. And in many cases, heartbeats wouldn't get through. Now if two cluster nodes are trying to speak to each other, they're sending heartbeats. This is their health check. And if those heartbeats don't get through, one of the nodes is going to think the other node's offline and then cause a failover, cause disruption in the environment. And that's not good because these nodes are still healthy. So what happens behind the scenes is anytime you deploy a virtual machine on the cluster, we change all of the heartbeat settings automatically. So we spread them out. If we know this is going to be a Hyper-V cluster, we're going to delay those heartbeats so they're sent less frequently, so we're less likely to trigger these false failovers. And all of these settings can be customized as well. All right, so let's talk about some of the optimizations around the host now that you kind of got those planning considerations down. The first best practice that we want to think about planning our host for virtualization is deploying a scale-out file server. Now, a scale-out file server essentially allows you to keep access to the virtual machine's disk always running. So as you know, whenever you're deploying anything on a cluster, you need some type of shared storage. The whole idea behind the shared storage is making sure that every node can access the data. So even if that's a SQL that's running directly on a cluster, we need that SQL database to be in shared storage. So if that SQL server runs on node 1 and crashes, it can restart on node 2 and still see that data. So shared storage has always been a requirement in clustering. Now, with virtualization, traditionally, you would go install your virtual machines on Fiber Channel, serial attached SCSI, iSCSI, things like that. And then with 2012, Microsoft introduced Hyper-V running over SMB, server message block. Now, what that basically meant was you could go and put your virtual disks, the data for the VMs, inside a file share. If you kind of think about what a file share is, it's almost like cheap shared storage, right? If I go to a file path, whack, whack, my share on one computer, I can see the data. If I do it from a different computer, I can also see the data. So essentially, a file share is almost like poor man's shared storage. Very easy to set up, very easy to use. But anytime you have a file server, and you're going to put that virtual hard disk there, you have a dependency on the file server being online. If that file server is not online, you don't have access to whack, whack, my share. So the virtual machine doesn't have access to its data. The virtual machine's not going to run. So this was a big problem. You know, we've always been able to cluster file servers and file shares. But if that file share crashes, it might take a minute or two to come up. And that's going to cause all of those virtual machines using data on that file share to not be available. So what Microsoft introduced was the scale-out file server. And what basically happens is you go and create a second cluster. And the whole role of the second cluster is to keep that file share highly available. And the way it does that, let's say I have a four-node scale-out file server. I'm going to put whack, whack, my share, whack, whack, my share, whack, whack, my share on all four nodes. What happens then is when a new request comes in to access the disk, the router is going to go spit it out to one of the different file paths. And there's basically four active file paths that that virtual machine can now access its disk through. So if one of those nodes crashes, not a problem. It'll reconnect to the next one, to the next one, to the next one. So basically, the whole idea behind the scale-out file server is high availability for the VM to go and access its virtual hard disk. So definitely something that you guys want to put in all of your cluster deployments here. Now, Microsoft also made a lot of enhancements around cluster shared volumes. And cluster shared volumes is the distributed access file system. Basically, it allows multiple nodes to go and write to a disk at the same time, but in a coordinated fashion, so that they don't go and corrupt the data that's on the disk. So CSV version 1, that came out with 2012, had some challenges. CSV version 2 came out with 2012 R2, and it now has a lot of enhancements around stability. There's options to do caching on it to save data, keep it more resilient. And it can also be used as part of this new scale-out file server that we were talking about. So whenever possible, go deploy cluster shared volumes. It allows you to go and share virtual disks. Now, I've also gone and added several slides about what's coming out with Windows Server 2016, talking about some of the latest enhancements coming down the line. And for those slides that are only relevant to 2016, you'll see a little badge in the bottom right corner to go and indicate that. So what Microsoft's been doing with Windows Server 2016 to improve the storage resiliency is fixing transient failures. And this is one of the biggest problems Microsoft heard from customers. And if you got 2012, 2012 R2, you're still going to have this challenge today. Now, this challenge is if I have a VM running on my node and I have an intermittent storage failure, meaning that the VM cannot go and connect to the storage, it's down for a while, that VM gets put into a that VM will actually crash and get put into a paused critical state, which means it can't access the data. What we try to do is go and build a lot of resiliency in here. So first thing we try to do is detect these crashes sooner so that we can start taking proactive recovery answers. What we then try to do here is go and redirect traffic from one of those hosts over to the other host through one of the shared storage paths and then redirect it back down to the file system. So the whole goal here is to make the cluster more resilient. When we have these temporary outages, don't take the virtual machine down. Try to keep it in a healthy state, try to reconnect it, reroute the traffic through another route. Now, this next feature is also coming in Windows Server 2016. And this is probably going to be one of the most popular features coming in the product, especially for SMBs. This feature allows you to build a cluster without any shared storage at all. So no file shares, no SANs, using only direct attached storage. What basically is happening here is you could take a three-node cluster, let's say, and using the direct attached storage disks, the DAS disks that are running locally, we basically create a three-way mirror. So when the data gets written to node one, it's automatically replicated to node two and node three, and vice versa. So this way you have consistent data across each of the nodes. So if one of the nodes crashes, we can restart an application somewhere else, and it still has a current copy of the data. Now, this is a version one implementation. So there are some limitations around this. Microsoft is still trying to figure out exactly what they are. Certain file systems may not be supported, like REFS. That's looking likely. But for the most part, this is going to be an easy-to-use, easy-to-set-up cluster. You know, for companies or organizations that do need that high availability, can't afford any type of shared storage. Now, similar to the storage resiliency, Microsoft also focused a lot on network resiliency as well. One of the other big complaints that we got is if two of the cluster nodes couldn't speak to each other, even if the virtual machines were healthy, we would do a failover. So what this would mean is, you know, you might have a perfectly healthy set of virtual machines running on one host, but simply because it's in a disconnected network, or there's a large amount of latency between your two sites, one of the nodes would think the other node has crashed. It would go and shut down the VMs and try to go start them up on the healthy node. So that was a big problem, especially when these VMs were still healthy. Simply, there was a network communication issue. So they've done a lot of advances around this. And when the two nodes become isolated, they can't speak to each other, they're still going to try to check that the VMs are healthy. And that a client can still connect to the VM running on the other node. Because that tells us, even if this one network path is saturated, unavailable, yet the VMs are running, let's keep sending clients to them. And instead of failing over, let's spend the time trying to rebranch, rebuild this network path. So this is going to keep your VMs up and running even longer. Now, another enhancement that they made to kind of address this scenario as well was there's this concept of nodes that are constantly failing. You know, if you've done a lot of clustering, you'll see that sometimes you just have a bad node, and it needs to have the whole OS reinstalled. Maybe there's a hardware failure. There's some other problem. So we introduced this new policy that will actually quarantine a node if it keeps having trouble. So what would happen in the traditional days today, if I had one virtual machine that crashed, everything would move over to the rest of my cluster. It would come back online. We would move things back to load balance, but then it would crash again. Load balance, it would come back online. And so it was constantly kind of moving back and forth as this node was healthy, unhealthy, healthy, unhealthy. So the cluster team, they introduced this new concept of a quarantine node. And if a node crashes more than 3 times in an hour, we basically freeze it. We say, hey, it looks like there's a problem here. We need an admin to go take a look at it. We're going to automatically place it into quarantine. The admin can then take it out once they feel it's safe. So it's kind of a safety guard, let the administrator go and investigate the problem before that continues, just to help minimize the amount of load balancing that's happening across the nodes. And all of these settings, they can be configured, that time interval, number of failures, things like that. Now, the next thing that we introduced as well is node maintenance mode. So if you do have a case like these flapping nodes that are going on and off, and you want to go put it into maintenance, you can simply select the node, put into maintenance node, and then you have the option to drain the roles or not drain them. And that basically means, do I want to go and evacuate it? Do I want to live migrate all the VMs or the other applications off it? So this is extremely useful when you're thinking about any type of maintenance operation. It's a great way to really kind of save you time so you're not manually live migrating everything. And as you're going to see in the next section, we're going to talk about VM priority. What you're actually going to see happen is high priority VMs get migrated first, then medium, then low. So this way, you know, we're kind of taking care of the most important VMs first, getting them onto a healthy system sooner. And then we have cluster-aware updating. Cluster-aware updating is a feature that lets you automatically patch your cluster nodes. Because one of the most boring, painful administrative tasks is cluster patching. You know, you got to go to each node, install the patch, reboot it. And you usually have to do them one at a time, because you can't take down all of your cluster nodes at once. So very tedious operation. The Virtual Machine Manager, they have an implementation of this that allows you to basically do all the patching automatically. And now this was built into the core product. So this is a new role that you can install through Server Manager. And what it is, it's basically an independent patching engine. It can run on a cluster node. It can run on an independent system. So there's no dependency that it has to be a cluster node. And what it's basically going to do is speak to Windows Update, figure out what patches you have, what patches you're missing, and then serially go and patch all of the cluster nodes. So the logic behind it, first it goes and scans each node, and it picks the node which has the fewest number of workloads on it, the fewest number of VMs. The reason why we do the one with the fewest is to minimize the number of live migrations. So if I have, you know, one host that only has two VMs, all my other hosts have 20 VMs, let's start with the one that has the fewest number of live migrations to go and test it, make sure that the patch works before we go and interfere with those other denser nodes. So we go to the one that has two VMs, we put it into pause node, so into maintenance. That automatically drains the virtual machines off it. It does live migration based on priority. And once that node is evacuated, we install the patches and we reboot if it's required. After the reboot, there's a couple of checks that are done. It's going to check that the host has been restarted. It's going to check that the cluster service has been restarted. And it's going to check that the installation code shows up as successful. Once we know, hey, this looks like a healthy patch, we'll then proceed to do all the other nodes in the cluster. So we pick the node with the next fewest, et cetera, and kind of cycle through. Anytime that a problem is hit, though, it's actually going to pause the operation and alert the administrator. So if one of the patches fails, it's not going to go and continue. And the whole idea behind that, if it's a bad patch, you don't want to go and apply that bad patch to every node in the cluster and then have to go roll them all back. So we kind of play it safe. We'll go, we'll progress, do everything automatically until we hit any issue. Then we pause, ask for guidance from the administrator. And then finally, we have this hidden button that prevents people from accidentally rebooting cluster nodes when there's applications running on it. Now, this is actually turned on by default. I believe it has a 2-minute interval. Don't quote me on that. It could be 5 minutes. But what basically happens is if somebody goes and says, I want to go and shut down this host, and there's virtual machines running on it, it's going to live migrate them to try to drain them, evacuate the host. Because we're now in an environment where we usually have multiple administrators using a single system. You know, one guy might be using the host as the virtualization guy, another guy might use it to go configure some storage. Storage guy, he might not know there's active VMs on it. So this is just kind of a safety mechanism to make sure that you don't accidentally kill your virtual machines. This timer, it's all configurable as well. So if you want to go and extend that interval to 10 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever makes sense, you can do that using PowerShell as well. So definitely a good tip, you know, and what we recommend here is you kind of test how long it takes to live migrate a standard workload. You know, if you only have 2 or 3 VMs on a host, the default's probably fine. If you're running hosts with, you know, 20 VMs, 100 VMs, something like that, you might want to go and push this up to a very, you know, like 60 minutes or something to make sure somebody doesn't accidentally go kill 100 of your virtual machines. Now, we also talked a little bit about the shared VHDX earlier. And again, this is our shared storage for guest clusters, for virtualized cluster nodes. Now, the whole reason why we had to go and develop this technology is actually for hosters and service providers. This was a big request that came from them. Because what these guys would do, you know, these big companies, let's say like GoDaddy or one of those hosting partners, they would go and give their customers 2 virtual machines. The customer would say, great, I want to go build a cluster out of this. I need access to your storage fabric. Well, for a lot of security reasons, hosters don't want to give tenants direct access to their storage fabric. They don't want to give them a LUN or even tell them how that storage is laid out. Because a smart tenant, he can actually use things like overrides where he can go and inject data into someone else's disk. Not good, right? So the whole idea behind this was to go and really kind of add a layer of separation between the underlying storage fabric and tenant virtual machines. So what the hoster could then do is they would go and carve one big LUN. Within that LUN, they would go and create a bunch of virtual hard disks, and then they could assign a specific virtual hard disk to a specific tenant. So from the tenant's perspective, they still got shared storage, but from the administrator's perspective, they didn't have to give access to an entire LUN. They could just give them access to one file running inside that LUN. So it added a lot of security there. So essentially, what this is, you need a guest cluster, 2 virtualized hosts, the application's data, like your SQL Server's database, that lives on that shared storage. Both virtual machines can access it. So shared VHDX, very important if you're going to be using guest clustering. All right, moving along to virtual machine optimization. So we kind of talked about the planning considerations. We talked about best practices for the host. Now these are best practices for the VMs themselves to give them more uptime. Now the first setting you always want to do is make sure that VM health monitoring is turned on. Now in 2012 R2, this is on by default. Earlier versions, this is off by default. So for those people still running 2008 R2 clusters, you want to go and turn on this property. And what this is basically going to do here is there's actually two tests here, two different heartbeat tests. The first one is going to check that the virtual machine itself is running. The second one is going to check whether the guest operating system within the VM is running to make sure that it hasn't blue screened or make sure there's no user mode hang. So this is really cool because sometimes you can have a perfectly healthy virtual machine from the outside, it's running, it's on, but something's crashed within that VM. So we can now detect that, we can tell if you've blue screened, and we can automatically restart it. So anytime you get one of those within guest crashes, we can refresh it, reboot it, restart the applications. So best practice, always turn this on. Now the second planning consideration around your virtual machines is which host they're going to live on. So there's two properties that you can choose to configure this, preferred owners and possible owners. Now, the challenge is these settings are actually within different property windows. So it's a little hard to find them. One of the settings is when you actually click on the VM itself. Another one is when you click on the virtual machine's configuration file. Honestly, not a very clean design consideration here, but that's kind of how it's set up. And so for that reason, a lot of people don't even know that these settings exist because, you know, they're kind of hidden in two different locations. Now, the very first setting is the preferred owner. So this is kind of like your first place. Which host would you want this application to run on if that host is available? So let's say, for example, you know, you have a very heavy SQL virtual machine. It requires 128 gigabytes of RAM. Some of your hosts may not even support that, right? You could have got some host from 5 years ago, bought some new ones last year, and so some hosts may not even have enough capacity to support that virtual machine. So that'd be a good example when you want to say, okay, only cluster node 3 and 4 can run this VM, cluster node 1 and 2, stay away from it. So it kind of gives you some best practices around the placement. Now by default, every host is a preferred owner. And so what this means is all of the hosts are fair. So if I deploy a new virtual machine, it has an equal opportunity to run on node 1, node 2, node 3, or node 4. So that's the default setting. And if you want to go and change that, you know, that's an optimization you can do. Now, the second level is a possible owner. So this is basically saying, I only want the application to run on this particular host here. Now, this is off by default. And what that means is all hosts are available for placement. And then there's the third consideration. What happens if nothing's available, if no preferred owners, no possible owners are available? Well, basically, we're not going to go start the application. So you really want to be cautious with these settings, right? You want to be able to prioritize them so your application goes to the right host, but you don't want to go too granular and configure it so that a VM may not ever start if one or two of your hosts are offline. Now, there's another property that most people don't know about, which is known as persistent mode. Now, this was actually exposed in the GUI back in 2008 R2. It was hidden in the later versions. And it's turned on by default. Now, what persistent mode is going to do is it's going to go and move the VM, or sorry, it's going to start the VM on the last host that you moved it to. Now, here's the whole scenario behind this. One of the biggest challenges in clustering is when the entire cluster crashes and you have to go and start up all of your virtual machines at once. That is one of the biggest engineering problems the cluster team ever solved, these entire node crashes. And here's why. Most people run their hosts at pretty high capacity, you know, 75% capacity, right? Pretty full. That's the whole idea of virtualization, get that consolidation. And they may be at that 75% during normal operating hours. All the VMs are running like usual, stays at that 75% level. The big challenge is when you actually start up a virtual machine, it actually is going to require more memory than just running it in usual operations most of the time. Because when you boot a virtual machine, You have to load drivers, applications, run startup scripts, connect to the network, connect to Active Directory. It's kind of a whole lot of things going on when you first boot a VM. So most performance patterns of virtual machines is it boots up, and then it kind of gradually goes down through normal operations. So if you have an entire cluster that crashes, you have all of these VMs that need to get restarted on it, and they're all trying to start at once using this much memory instead of this much, it can actually cause what's known as a startup storm. Too much memory tries to start on a single host. That host gets overloaded. That host crashes. Everything moves to the next host. That one's overloaded and crashes. And it can actually cause a domino effect, taking down every node in the cluster. So you've got to be really, really careful about these entire cluster crashes, avoiding these startup storms. So the good thing is that was around 2008, 2008 R2. You guys should upgrade soon. They did fix that problem in 2012 and onwards. So the first thing that they did was this persistent mode. What happens now? When the cluster node starts, the very first one that comes online, we don't try to move every VM to it and have 100 VMs all start on one node. We only try to start the VMs that were running on it before it crashed. So maybe I'm only trying to start 20 on this. When the next node comes online, I start the 20 VMs that were running on this node, third node, those VMs. And what it's basically going to do is stagger the startup, so we're not trying to put all the VMs on the first node that comes online. So one of the common questions is, OK, so what happens if my host never starts, right? I have a five-node cluster, four of them boot. I've got my 20 VMs, 20, 20, 20. What happens to those final ones? Where are they going to go? Well, there is a built-in timer. We're going to give it, I believe it's 5 minutes by default. And if this last host doesn't come up after that five-minute interval, hopefully these guys have had a chance to start up. They've kind of leveled out a little. We'll then go and start these remaining VMs across those other active hosts. So there is kind of a timing interval there. It's going to wait a little bit, try to put it on the preferred host. If not, it's still going to bring them online, just a little slower. Now, the next big setting that we want to think about here as well is the virtual machine priority. Virtual machine priority is used in a couple of ways. The easy way to think about it is how important is this virtual machine? So anytime that we have a whole cluster crash and we try to start things up, we're actually going to start things up based on the priority. We will try to start all the high priority VMs first, then medium, then low. So this kind of staggers the startup a little better. When you put VMs into maintenance mode or a host into maintenance mode, it does the same thing. It live migrates the important ones first, then medium, then low. Now, a couple ways that some people use this in a couple of interesting ways. Most people are going to use it by tagging their key infrastructure services as high priority. So if they're rebooting their entire environment, they get things like their domain controller up and running first. Medium priority might be databases. Low priority might be websites, things like that. And so we also see people use this configuration if they have multi-tiered applications. Bring up the database first, the business level second, the website third. So a couple different ways that you can go use these settings as well. Another thing to consider as well, if there's not enough memory to run all of the virtual machines and you have crashes, we will actually shut down low priority VMs and start high priority VMs instead of them. This is a mechanism known as preemption. So, you know, let's say I have a five node cluster, two of my nodes crash, I only have low priority running on these guys. Well, we're going to do a failover and we're going to start our high priority VMs and shut down some of the lower priority VMs. Still trying to go and maximize all of the resources there. So that's known as preemption. And then the final setting here is no auto start. What this setting basically means is this is a very unimportant virtual machine. Maybe it's like dev test, marketing team, something like that. And it's not going to start when the entire cluster crashes. It has to be manually started later. You laughing at marketing? Yeah, I'm one of the marketing guys now. My VMs are always started last. It's OK. So what's essentially happening here, you let the entire infrastructure get healthy first. And then once everything's running, your key infrastructure's OK. You'll then go back in and manually go and start all of these less important VMs. So it's a way to kind of help avoid these startup storms as well. So keep that in mind. Number one tip, think about startup storms when you're planning your highly available environment. Now, another thing a lot of people need to do is actually distribute virtual machines across different hosts. So there's a way to do that. And unfortunately, it's hidden pretty well through a private cluster property known as anti-affinity class name, really easy to use, right? The whole scenario behind this is if you have virtual machines that are running the same application, you don't want them running on a single physical host. Let's say I have two virtualized domain controllers. I put them on one single host. I lose my host. I've lost both my domain controllers at once. That is still a single point of failure. So for any virtual machines running the same workload, whether that's domain controllers, SQL Server, or even a guest cluster or virtualized cluster, our whole idea is to go and spread them out, purposely place them on different hosts to avoid those single points of failure. So the way we do that setting, we go and provide a friendly name for this anti-affinity class name. Let's say it's SQL. Every virtual machine with the SQL tag will purposely try to spread itself out. So if I have a four-node cluster, four VMs, it's going to go one-to-one. If I have a four-node cluster and five VMs, one of the hosts is going to have two, but it will still try to distribute it out as evenly as possible. So we are going to keep it online. We may have two or more on a single host, depending on your own policies, how many applications you have, but they will come online. Now, live migration has been improved significantly as well. So with 2012, 2012 R2, we started supporting concurrent live migrations, which essentially means we can move multiple VMs at once. There's no limitations on how many that you can do simultaneously. So one of the big questions that people always ask is, well, why wouldn't I turn it up to 100 or 1,000, right? Why wouldn't I have as many live migrations as possible? That's good, right? It means things move faster. Not true. There's actually a sweet spot in the optimal number of live migrations that's about 4 to 8, depending on what type of application you're doing. Here's why. When you actually do a live migration, two of the nodes have to be online, and they're basically sending data from one to the other. Now, if I can go and copy that data between for one virtual machine in 1 minute, I might be able to do two virtual machines in 2 minutes. But if I go up to 10, it might take me 20 minutes or 30 minutes. It slows down. There's kind of an odd pattern in there. And the whole reason why is every time I do this live migration, let's say it takes 1 minute, while all of that data is being copied over that 60 seconds, changes are still happening on my original host. So I have 60 seconds of changes here that I now need to copy over again. And that might take 2 seconds. But in that 2 seconds, changes are still happening. I have to copy that again. And so there's basically this recursive algorithm that's going to go and move everything over. So if you do one virtual machine, pretty straightforward, right? Now let's say I'm doing 10 virtual machines at once. When I'm going and copying, it might take 10 minutes to do that first one. But in that 10 minutes, I now have 10 minutes of changes and 10 virtual machines. So the second one might take me 8 minutes and then 6 minutes. So the overall time actually spikes and peaks once you hit a certain threshold. So be careful when you're doing that. Test your performance. Use real production workloads, because that's kind of the biggest factor in live migration time. It's what's happening within the virtual machine. When we do a live migration, we are copying the memory. The more memory that's changing, like in a SQL database, it takes longer to copy. Less memory that changes, or if no memory changes, we do it in that first minute. There's nothing that I have to go back to the second time. So when you test this, find that pattern, try to find that perfect ground for you based on your applications and workloads. Next, we have live migration queuing. So let's say I can only do 4 virtual machines at once. I want to live migrate 10. That's OK. We'll live migrate the first 4 that have the highest priority, and the next 4, then the next 2. So rather than clicking and waiting, you can just do multi-select, live migrate, and it will queue them up. We also have live migration compression. This is now on by default in 2012 R2. The whole concept here, before I go and copy this memory, I go compress it first, copy it, uncompress it. So the fact that we're sending less data means the live migration goes faster. So that's good in general. The only downside of doing live migration with compression is it's going to take up extra CPU cycles. So the fact that I have to do a compression here and then uncompress it over on this side means I'm doing extra churn. So it's kind of a trade-off. What's more important to you, the speed of the live migration or keeping those extra CPU cycles free, using them for the workloads? We have also live migration over RDMA. So RDMA is remote direct memory access. It's basically a type of networking card that's been enhanced. It's very fast, and it can directly interact with the host memory. So when you do live migration with RDMA, and you have this supported hardware, it could go about 5 to 10 times faster than a standard live migration. Because as it's doing the copy, it's much more efficient in how it places that virtual machine in the memory on the destination. And there's also an option to move the VM to the node with the most free memory as well. If you click move, you'll see an option that says move to the best available node within Failover Cluster Manager. This is going to automatically move it to the node that has the least amount of memory. Sorry, that has the most amount of free memory. So I basically place it on the best node based on memory. With new type of live migrations, we can migrate our storage. We can migrate over the network. We can migrate both our storage and our network simultaneously. So you can have two standalone hosts that can now do a live migration. And we also have built-in replication available as well. So a lot of people, they say, wait, I can now do a live migration between two standalone hosts. Why would I need a cluster? Keep in mind, the cluster's not just there for live migration. The cluster's there for planned and unplanned failures. So remember, those two nodes are talking to each other. One of the node crashes, we detect, we do a failover, we restart it. So clustering is still critical for high availability, restarting your applications. So Hyper-V Replica, I'm out of time. I'm going to wrap this one up quickly now. Hyper-V Replica, inbox replication solution. This is where we can take a virtual hard disk, copy it to a secondary location every 5 minutes, 30 seconds, or 15 minutes. We could copy it from a second to a third location if we want. And we can even control this type of replication through Azure. Now, when you do Hyper-V Replica on a cluster, it is slightly different, because we have to go and deploy a new role known as the Hyper-V Replica Broker. Now, the whole idea behind Hyper-V Replica on a cluster is that we want to make the replication highly available as well. We figure that if you're putting a VM on a cluster, it's probably an important VM. So you want to always make sure that the replication is happening as well. So what we've done here is this Replica Broker, it's essentially a new clustered role. So the cluster runs it on one node. If that node crashes, this engine moves to a different node. So this basically means this job that processes the replication, that is always highly available as well. So as long as your cluster's online, this replication engine's online, you'll still continue to replicate your virtual machines. And now with Windows Server 2016, they've introduced inbox asynchronous replication as well. This is one of the other big popular features. I can now replicate any type of disk using from any type of file system between nodes. So this will be a great enhancement to give you replication between two different sites with zero downtime. Another thing they've introduced with the next version as well is if you have two sites, clustering has this concept of a witness. And a witness is essentially a voter. We can now use Microsoft Azure to help us figure out which of the two data centers has the most availability and which should stay online, which data center should stay offline. So you're starting to see even more combination with Microsoft Azure, even with a traditional on-premise platform like failover clustering. So as we wrap it up here, hopefully you guys learned a lot. This is a very dense, very technical session, a lot of best practices here. And just keep these planning things in mind. Try to use a version of Windows Server that doesn't have a GUI. Fewer patches, fewer updates. Make sure you test your live migration patterns to optimize the number of simultaneous live migrations. Make sure you understand how your cluster behaves if there's an entire crash and you have to simultaneously start dozens of VMs at the same time, avoiding those startup storms. So across this, hopefully you got a lot of best practices here. The presentation will be available through the SCU network. So please download it, take a look at it, use these best practices in your environment today. Thank you.